Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each episode we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today, we are talking about The Killer, the 2023 film, screenplay by Andrew Kevin Walker, directed by David Fincher, based on the graphic novel series The Killer by Metz and Luc Jacquemont. Hopefully. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello, Mr. Petrie.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Okay, so we are in week six of our Auteur Autumn Fall season. We are looking at David Fincher today. We started this whole thing with Seven in anticipation of knowing The Killer was going to be coming out. So we talked a little bit in the very first episode of our fall season on Seven. Now we're going to dive into The Killer. Next week, we are switching to Ridley Scott, and we're talking about Prometheus on the... Beyond the Screenplay Patreon, it's going to be a lot of fun and I think very instructional. I think you can learn a lot by studying that movie. And then we'll, of course, talk about Napoleon the week after, and that'll be our finale. Okay, but so for now, The Killer. So what's kind of fun is kind of out of the blue, I got an invite to the LA premiere of The Killer by person at Netflix, and that was pretty neat. And so I got to go. It was held at the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures over by LACMA, which seems really cool. Trisha, I know you've been
Oh, yeah, it's amazing.
It seems like such a cool place. Got to walk the red carpet, and that was kind of neat, and like sit in the theater. The theater is amazing. And then afterward, there's a Q&A with Fincher and the rest of the filmmaking team, the cinematographer and the editor and the screenwriter and Ren Kleiss, the sound designer. So it was really cool. It was a really fun night. Thank you, Netflix, for inviting me. Next time, send me 4 invites, and then we can all go and report back. That would be really fun. I don't know what to make of this movie. I'm just going to say this out loud right now. As we're looking at different auteur things that happen, sometimes if you're a big fan of an auteur, you can become extremely saturated by their thing, such that like it's hard to even know what a non-you person makes of their work. And I feel like that's the point where I'm at with David Fincher now, where I'm watching this movie and I'm just like, I've seen that shot before. I've seen that tilt before. I've seen this camera move before. The way you can look at a Wes Anderson movie and be like, oh, it's a Wes Anderson shot. I have that with like shots of the back of people's heads with Fincher, just because I've seen so many Fincher films. I've studied them. He's obviously a big inspiration. I love a lot of his films. But I just don't know what to, like, to make of this. So I'm really curious to hear you guys talk about this movie. My general experience was I was pretty into it in the first 20 minutes. Something goes wrong. There's Rear Window vibes. And I was like, oh, okay, something went wrong. Inciting incident, let's go. And then it kind of like meandered a little bit. And we started a revenge thing around the midpoint. It felt like, oh, maybe this is a movie about this guy's obsession with perfection and his mantra like falling apart. And he's going to learn that he's going to have complex emotions and go on some kind of arc is where I was at the midpoint. Uh-huh. And then the second half of the movie, that didn't happen. He just kind of kept killing people, was sort of my experience of it. So I don't know how I feel about this movie. There are parts I really, really liked, but as a whole, the experience was sort of like, yeah, okay, that was interesting. So I want to hear from you guys. Alex, what did you make of this movie?
Yeah, I saw this movie in theaters, which I was happy about because the thing that stood out to me really the most of all was the sound design. I thought it was just an exquisite exercise in like crisp, precise, perfect sound design. So seeing it in a really good theater with really good sound, I thought was like most of what I appreciate about the experience, honestly. And I think, you know, the movie does just like, you feel like you're in the hands of somebody who's a master of the craft. And that always feels good, where you just feel like every shot, and you know, Fincher is a perfectionist. So you know, every shot is exactly how he wants it. He probably did 100 takes. He probably, you know, color corrected it and then did it again and then VFX'd in some snow. And so it's like, I know all this and I like it. It's fun to be just like kind of held in a movie that's so formally perfect. It reminded me in some ways of No Country for Old Men, you know, where it's got the same kind of attention to sound design. And there's a lot of like 2+2 going on throughout the story. And so I liked it as this formal experience. But as you were saying, Michael, it these pieces never came together. There's this really constant voiceover happening, the like endless repeating of mantras. And it seemed that something thematic is happening there. And it seems that there's some statement being made, maybe about capitalism or some kind of weird work ethic. But you know, when it ends and when it kind of lands on him saying in the last line, you know, maybe I'm one of the many as well, I didn't know what that meant in the context of the story I had just seen or what had just happened or what changed. And so it was a little frustrating. It was kind of like all these pieces were presented to me and there's this really obvious narration presented atop all of it that didn't seem to cohere into that satisfying kind of period at the end that it seemed like the movie was saying it gave me. So the other thing that's interesting that we could talk about this is just like watching it in a movie theater and then watching it casually at home as I was like cooking and doing chores in that kind of like Netflix second screen sort of way was a different experience where it was kind of like I didn't have the same expectations of it. It was kind of like this could just be, you know, 5 20-minute episodes of Michael Fassbender like doing assassin stuff, and that would have almost like felt better than being presented as a feature film for 2 hours. So we can get into that, but I think there's something interesting here too of like it is a Netflix movie, and you know, should every movie be a movie? If this is split into chapters and doesn't add up to a movie catharsis, maybe it shouldn't be a movie. So those are all my thoughts.
Yeah, nice. Okay, Trisha, what about you?
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you guys a quick little story about my experience with this movie, which was, so I've seen the last 3 of our movies for Auteur Autumn in the same movie theater, which is a newish theater in the LA area, and I won't call out the name of it here because they are still working out a few kinks.
Oh no! Oh,
boy. And so this time around, I like got my tickets and I went, and I was like, I'm trying to see this in the theater and I'm trying to do it the most correct way possible. But I walk in there like at basically the starting time of the movie and there's nobody at all in the theater. And I'm like, okay, this is fine, weird, you know, but it is coming out on Netflix in 2 days. So like maybe everybody's just waiting for that. So I like wait and wait and wait like 15 minutes past the start time of the movie. And a couple other people trickle in, but still commercial, you know, just like commercials are showing. And I'm like, okay, you guys really got to get this started now. So finally the trailers start, and as the trailers are going, they're like for like horror movies. And you know how much I love horror movies. And I was just like, oh, okay, I can't even watch these trailers right now. And like, who do they think is here to see The Killer by David Fincher? Like, there's a trailer for that Thanksgiving movie that I really don't want to see that looks extra dumb. And there's one about an evil swimming pool, apparently, that I simply closed my eyes for the entirety of that trailer. And I was just like, this is horrible. Finally, the movie starts, and within 5 seconds, I'm like, oh no, I'm in the wrong theater.
Oh no.
The Blumhouse logo came up, and I was like, nope, 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 nope. And I walked out of the theater, and I had been sitting in Five Nights at Freddy's. And in my defense, there was very, very bad signage. So... Mm-hmm. I walked into this movie a solid 20 minutes late after having endured horror movie trailers and the first 15 seconds of Five Nights at Freddy's. And I walked in literally right as the killer shoots the wrong person. And I was just like, interesting. Yeah. And then about 20 minutes before the start of this podcast, I went back and caught the beginning of it. So I have seen it all now. but my experience was closer to what you're talking about, Alex, where I was just sort of episodic and I was just, you know, kind of watching it at my own pace, apparently. Yeah, wow. That one actually is on me. There was bad signage, but I probably could have figured it out. I know what you mean at that
theater.
Sooner.
It's like the posters are next to the theater entrances, but it could be left or right. So
there's like six theaters at the end of the hall and just six posters anywhere. anyway.
And then just a cutout of a guy shrugging.
And there's no one to ask. Anyway, listen. Overall, I think this movie is fascinating. There was a moment in the middle of it, as it's sort of cooking along in the middle of the second act, where I was just like, hell yeah, I'm into this kind of movie. Like, I really like the here's somebody really good at their job movie. And that's, this is that, like, that's all this is. And I dig that, right? There's something really fun about the attention to detail and the attention to detail of the central character matching up with David Fincher's attention to detail. I think all of it is really fascinating. It's actually really, it's episodic, but the episodes themselves are really taut and watchable, I think. That being said, I walked out of it and couldn't agree more about it feeling thematically hollow, or at least thematically muddy. Thinking back on it and having watched the first 20 minutes of it now, I actually think there's a really interesting, maybe like meta theme that kind of is percolating under it. But I do think that there's, you know, we can get to it, but there's an anticlimax to the final confrontation. Like, even if you want to be generous with the read of like Fincher's commenting on his own work or late stage capitalism and his participation in it, which I think those things are maybe in there. There's still like, I feel like you kind of have to, you have to point us to what you want us to see. So like, even if it's in there, you have to tell us it's what it is with the filmmaking. And that final confrontation with the final boss, just, I'm not sure does that. And neither does the very brief coda, but I'm like desperate to get to all of that with you guys. So yeah, that was, my scattered experience with the movie, The Killer.
Cool. Okay. And Brian, what about you?
Yeah. You know, I feel like I thematically connected to this movie really well. So I'm excited to talk about all of that. Like, there was something that clicked for me where I went, oh, okay. And then I just sort of rode that through to the end. I agree it's muddy, and I agree that I wish there were certain things where it was like, oh, that's a more clear choice, or that thing means that more. But also the fact that it's a little muddy meant my partner and I were talking about it the whole way home. We went on a hike this morning. We were talking about it. It's like we've kind of discussed this movie and like the theme and the protagonist like more than we have in, I don't know, 2 years or something of other movies that we've seen. I think that's really cool. And I'm really excited to talk about it with you guys. And yeah, I'm sort of having two, in terms of just my overall thoughts about the movie, I'm having these two different thoughts, one of which is the movie itself. Like I said, I found the themes to be interesting. I was entertained. I liked it a lot. And then there's this meta macro thing from an auteur autumn standpoint where I'm like, I want more from Fincher, who maybe is my favorite filmmaker. And I feel like this is just like you took 6 years off, you know, to go do House of Cards and Mindhunter and that kind of thing. And then you came back with Mank and then The Killer. And I'm kind of like, where's the next big one? Where's the next Fincher movie that really pushes that envelope? You know, and I think regardless of how you feel about the last Tarantino, Nolan, Scorsese movie, like they all feel like this is a person who is doing the thing that they do at 10 and pushing the envelope and kind of doing something that feels like this is interesting and exciting and maybe kind of weird. And they're doing it really well, generally speaking. And I feel like this movie feels a little familiar. It feels a little safe. It feels a little, you know, kind of just, I'm at home. I saw the theater and it's like, no, I kind of feel like I'm at home on a couch watching this on Netflix, you know, like there's that sort of weird, like, kind of feeling to it. So yeah, again, the movie in a vacuum, I like a lot. And then sort of, oh, this is what I get for now. You know, it's just sort of, I want a little bit more. But also, Fincher doesn't owe me anything, and I want him to make things. I want him to make things, and I want him to make things that he is excited to make, and I'm happy that he is doing that. You know, so I'm forever supportive of whatever that is. But there's definitely a part of me that's going, yeah, but when's the next Seven or Fight Club or Social Network? Like, when's the next thing that feels like it's a boom in the sort of cinematic landscape, I guess.
Yeah. As we move through our October autumn season, I continue to think that there is no one better to sponsor our show than Mubi. Mubi is a streaming service where each and every film is hand-selected by expert curators who are passionate about elevating great cinema. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs from all around the world, there's always something new to discover. And here to tell you about one such film you can discover on Mubi is our very own Brian Bittner.
Well, speaking of auteurs, Room 237 is a documentary on Mubi about Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining. And it's really fascinating because it's interviews with several different people who have their own theories about what it means. Like, this means he's talking about faking the moon landing, and you can tell by like the rocket ship on Danny's sweater and this and that. And everyone's opinion is so detailed. And I remember watching it just thinking, like, some of this seems a little far-fetched. And then I realized, oh, the filmmakers know that at best only one of these, you know, eight people being interviewed can be right. They're just taking a sort of almost non-judgmental, instead of saying, here's what we think The Shining is about, they're just sort of letting other people tell you what they think it's about. It's really fascinating. It's really interesting to hear all the theories, just all the thought that these people have put into it. So yeah, Room 237 on Mubi, highly recommended.
Thanks. Kind of sounds like personality tests, where to me half of the fun is watching people react to their personality test. Like, reveals more about the people.
Right. The Shining is one big Rorschach test.
Right. Awesome. Cool. Well, and with a 30-day free trial, you can experience Mubi's library of films for yourself. And by signing up, you're also supporting Beyond the Screenplay and helping us to continue to make new episodes. So why not try Mubi for free today? Just head to Mubi.com/beyond the screenplay to start your free trial and discover a world of great cinema. That's MUBI.com/beyond the screenplay. Thank you to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Yeah, I feel kind of similar. The note that I wrote to myself was like, I miss movies where Fincher was telling a story. Like, I feel like both this and like Mank, you know, there are narrative elements, like the story is being told, but like, going back to, yeah, like Gone Girl, Social Network, like Dragon Tattoo, Seven, like really cinematic, epic stories, lots of things happening. Like that's the Fincher that I really love. And I think he does a really great job doing those things. And it does feel like there's been more. Mank was obviously a personal project. This feels kind of like a personal project also. And like, it's cool that we have a Netflix that allows directors to do personal projects that couldn't be done elsewise. But it is that, like, but I also want a little bit of like forced constraints, like make it like, I want him to make a movie that has to open on a Friday night, like he talked about when he was making Panic Room. Like, I don't know. So yeah, I also have a lot of like,
you meta. Want more Panic Room.
I would definitely take a Panic Room.
I love Panic Room.
Yeah.
I want to clarify like that we're hearing you right. Yeah, you want more Panic Room from David Fincher.
I would, like I said, I would certainly take a Panic Room.
All right.
We're going to talk about Panic Room at some point.
We're going to zoom through the handle of a mug and talk about Panic Room.
Perfect.
Okay. Well, yeah. So a lot of things on the table here. Themes. The Fincherness of it all, the perfectionism, the sound design. Something that struck me, though, that I'm kind of curious to dive into for a second, and you guys have already mentioned this, is voiceover. As like, I hadn't thought about that as being a Fincher thing, but it kind of is a Fincher thing. Like, thinking about Fight Club, very heavy with voiceover. Benjamin Button has voiceover. Gone Girl has voiceover.
Yeah. House of Cards.
Yeah.
House of Cards.
Constant, yeah, talking to camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just interesting use of voiceover. And I think, you know, that's very front and center in this movie, obviously. And I think that's kind of what made me wake up to that. And the way it's used in this movie is really interesting. Like, this movie is clearly playing with perspective a lot, and it's very subjective. You're in, like, Michael Fassbender's head sometimes, but also just in the spaces with him sometimes. The sound is, like, very literal, like, in terms of its orientation to the camera. It's one of the things they talked about at the Q&A was Ren Kleiss, the sound designer, saying they almost wanted it to feel like there was a camera or there was a microphone attached to the top of the camera pointed at whatever the camera was pointed at. And so if you're cutting from a shot and it's 90 degrees rotated, the sound's going to rotate 90 degrees also. And that's a little like unconventional. And so, yeah, just interesting use of perspective. I'm curious kind of what you guys make of the voiceover. We have this protagonist who really says very few lines. And even in the voiceover, a lot of what he's saying is the same mantra over and over again. So, yeah, just curious what you guys like made of this and in general, Fincher's use of voiceover in his films.
Well, I think one thing I do appreciate about this movie a lot is the focus of the story, right? Where there's nothing superfluous to this particular character's like journey from point A to point B to point C to point D, you know, throughout the story. So there's no B plot. There's no, like, there are no other plot threads that are interwoven anywhere. There's nothing else that's like gonna pay off or come back. It's like we're just with the killer. That is his name. And we're just with the protagonist of the movie, Michael Fassbender's character. And that's it, right? And so when you have, which I think is fascinating, but does place you in sort of a difficult structural place where often when we're like trying to track with a character, we're seeing them in a variety of situations where, right, like think about the beginning of Casablanca where, you know, we see Humphrey Bogart's character, Rick, he's interacting with other people in the cafe, his staff. We see him talking to, you know, the... Peter Lorre's character, whose name I'm not going to remember.
Right, the Peter Lorre right. character.
Yeah. Right. Oh, well, yeah,
but, I'll get it. I'll remember. Yeah.
There are these like little tests, right? Or these little situations that the character is placed in where we can start to see their facade as well as their true self or, you know, the virtues that they espouse and the way that they act in these other little tests. But when you have this razor focus on this sort of one track story, then you're kind of forced into a place where there's nothing else to show us who the character is. So you're basically putting yourself in a position of having to tell us who the character is. So the only way to do that really is in voiceover, unless you give the character somebody to talk to, which isn't logical in this situation. He's going to just have to talk directly to us. And I think it works okay. I think it's like, for the most part, when we hear the character's voiceover, it's just this mantra. It's just these values. And yet the thrust of the plot, once his partner is, you know, injured, is totally in opposition to those values that he claims, right? He is fighting a battle he has not been paid to fight. He is getting emotional, right? He has empathy for the girlfriend's brother who's like there for a second. He's obviously acting in a way outside of his value system. And so his constant repeating of that fact doesn't change the fact that whatever it is that he's doing is not in line, is his true self, right? It's not his facade acting at that time. And so it's okay. I think there's too much of it at the end of the day. Like the first 20 minutes are just that. And I get it. I get the pacing. I know what you're doing, David Fincher. I'm like, I see all of the details. It's really fun to see Michael Fassbender doing yoga, talking about murdering people. I'm into all of that. But also, it's the first 20 minutes of the movie that's just that, which I just saw 20 minutes ago. And I was like, wow, this is what I missed. Okay. But yeah, like I don't know. I think that that's an interesting, you're kind of putting yourself in an interesting screenwriting challenge puzzle by telling the story that you're telling in this way.
Mm-hmm. Also think about the fact that this is based on a graphic novel.
Right.
And I can almost picture the things he's saying as those little, you know, kind of like square text bubbles alongside these images of the killer doing his routine. And so there's something interesting too about that translation from graphic novel to screen. There's a certain type of writing and a type of inner monologue that I think almost pairs with kind of comics or graphic novels that is just different from other types of monologues. And I could actually feel that in this movie. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it felt right that this came from a graphic novel. But I agree with you, Tricia. It was interesting how wall to wall it was in that first 20 minutes, to the point where it was almost threatening to kind of zone me out. Like it was so constant that it the dynamics weren't there anymore. It was just a constant monologue. And so, Michael, you said that you were kind of like hooked in those first 20 minutes. I was actually getting a little worried. I was like, is this the whole movie? Is it going to just be this? And then I was really relieved when, you know, the assassination goes wrong and there's suddenly a plot development. And then I was hooked. But those first 20 minutes were actually kind of rough for me to get through because of that wall-to-wall nature of it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, this was going to be part of my lesson, but I'll just throw it out now and figure out what my lesson is later. Which is, I was totally into it for those first 20 minutes. And I think there's something I was thinking about was, we're used to movies about someone with a staunch philosophy and then a story world that challenges it, right? It's always sort of throwing things at him to make him change his mind. And I think it's really interesting when the challenges are coming from the protagonist himself, where he is saying the things, he's saying his mantra, and then something makes him go, no, stick to the plan, you know, don't do this, right? And there's, what's the old, like, Trisha, you probably know the old like English 101 stuff that was like man versus nature, man versus man versus self, right?
That's how they teach you themes,
right? Yeah, exactly. So I think this is very much a sort of man versus self thing, where he is, we are watching him and listening to him struggle with the things that he is telling himself and continues to tell himself all the way up until the end of the movie, which totally works for me, that like he's just like miserable. Fincher loves his movies about like someone who has a really serious philosophy and at the end is just miserable as a result, like like Tyler Durden or Mark Zuckerberg, you know, just sort of like, oh yeah, that got you nowhere. And the last shot of the movie is just this person being not any better than they were at the beginning. So I think voiceover is a very interesting way to communicate that to the audience, where the voiceover is not just doing narrative work. Of course, it also is in character work, but it is doing like this sort of thematic pressure onto the protagonist's own self work, where he is saying a thing and he is convincing himself of something. And he is like, by telling us his philosophies, he's convincing himself of this thing that who knows if he actually believes it, but he feels like he has to in order to sleep at night at all.
Yeah.
Interesting too. Part of what's at odds with his narration is just the fact that he kind of screws up a lot in this movie. And there's actually some comedy there. Like, I think that the movie actually has a lot of funny moments just because it's like, oops, that wasn't supposed to happen. And it's interesting to see a character that both like fulfills the fantasy of the hyper perfectionist, like, you know, killer. You know, he has his neatly organized license plates and everything is that kind of like Fincher fantasy of like a perfect system that you have because you're so good at your job. And yet he's also like screwing up pretty regularly, or just making misjudgments or not quite getting it right. Even the dog isn't fed quite the right amount of medicine to not wake up. So it's they're interesting. Like, yeah, we have the narration that is almost the fantasy of the Fincher perfect serial killer and the reality, which is kind of at odds with it.
Yeah, well, and to me, that's definitely the most interesting part of this movie. And I think those first 20 minutes, besides feeling kind of Rear Window-ish, and it was fun to just watch Fincher do like those things, that there was so much narration. It did feel like Fight Club. And it kind of felt like, you know, because we were in the setting up of the movie stage, I had a feeling that it was setting up something that was going to be turned on its head in some way. I do think it probably could have gotten there a little bit sooner, but I think because so much time was spent on seeing how perfectionist he is, like by the end of it, I do believe, oh, he's going to knock this off. It's going to be perfect. And then when he misses, you know, the gap, it was that much bigger for me. And then I was like hooked and like into the movie. And every time those moments, like you're calling out, Alex, where he's reciting his mantra, we see him, you know, when it goes to New Orleans to kill the lawyer beast. Guy. Yeah. You know, we're seeing how perfectionist he is. He knows he can count the number of seconds before the door closes so that he can slip in unnoticed, like all this stuff. And then it comes to the moment and he puts the nails in the chest and he's concocted this perfect like scenario where this guy is going to tell him exactly what he needs to know so he can call 911. But then the narration is like, you know, male this age should last 7 minutes. Blah, and the person's dead. And he like has a head tilt of like, that didn't go as planned. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that's basically the midpoint. So, yeah. You know, again, to borrow the words that you were saying earlier, Trisha, like the facade and inner self, like I feel like the voiceover and the actions, like all those were layering really well together for me in the first half to put together, just an interesting, engaging experience. It's just that then it never like continued to develop past that. You know, in our collateral episode, we talk about how inner self and facade, they're on kind of a crash course. In the middle is where these two, like the line going down of the facade being worn away and the inner self rising, those collide in the midpoint. And then the second half is sort of continuing those trajectories and flipping it on its head. I don't know that that happens in this movie. I feel like
I think it's the opposite that happens. I think what I found so fascinating about the character arc and the theme of this movie was how and when the filmmakers are pushing you away from the character. So with Killers of the Flower Moon, we talked about what's character flaw stuff that maybe you could forgive for now and then they'll redeem themselves later, and what's no, this is just a bad person, right? And I was thinking a lot about Nightcrawler and American Psycho with this movie, where those are movies where like right off the bat, they're just like, this is a bad person. Like you are just going to watch a movie about a bad person and you can enjoy that and you can have a blast watching like themes and all this kind of stuff. This movie is like, okay, he's an assassin, fine. And then you've got the cab driver, which is that moment of like, oh man, I wish you hadn't done that. Mm-hmm. But okay, like I'll stick with it here and we'll see, you know, like I'm not on your side, but like, okay. And then the sort of plot midpoint, I think, is him getting the information that he needs from Dolores is her name, the assistant. And then the character midpoint is when he chooses to kill her. And to me, that was when I went, oh, okay. The movie is saying, if you at all were still with this guy, like, no, like you, if you are still with this guy at this point, like that's on you, I guess. But for me, it was just like, no, he definitely didn't have to do that. She already knew who he was and she had all the information, right? So she's not going to do anything. That was to me saying he has made this choice. So maybe it's the facade taking over to your point, Michael, right? Where it's like, now he is just he's just this, like there is no, okay, we're going to redeem this guy by the end. But then I was able to engage with the movie in a different way, like watching Nightcrawler from the beginning, where I'm going, okay, if you're just telling me this person is not someone I'm going to morally align with, then I can have a good time and think about it thematically. So then I was like, oh yeah, this is just a movie about someone who worries about himself and doesn't care about what else is around him. And I think that's really interesting. We'll get into it later, but like, that's really interesting. State of the world right now, state of people is just, you know, we are worried about ourselves. We're not worried about who over there is suffering because we just want to take care of ourselves. This movie has a lot of Amazon Postmates. Like, look at how easy it is to just kind of live your own life and do your own thing. And if a person that you care about is in trouble, then you're going to go do whatever you have to do. But if this person over here on, you know, this cab driver or this is whatever, if they're in your way, well, that doesn't matter because they don't, they're not real people. They're over there, you know? And I think to me, that's what I engage with so, so hard thematically with the movie. And that's why the second half, once that Dolores moment happens, I was like, oh, okay, now I'm fully committed to why do I not like, what do I fully hate about this character? And then what does that mean? And then the fact that at the end, he is still trying to convince himself that what he is doing is right. And his lie twitches right there before the credits, right? I'm just like, oh yeah, you're telling me that, that this way of being is absolutely not like a good way of being, obviously. And I, that's what I found really engaging about the second half of the movie. Once that was sort of, that moment was kind of confirmed for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because that, which maybe this is just talking about how many layers are kind of happening in this movie, but I read that midpoint as kind of the opposite, where like, to me, him killing the cab driver was like, you didn't need to, like, this, I don't know, he's a kid, like, that was bad.
Sure.
Him killing Dolores was like, you didn't need to do that, but at least you gave her like the death she wanted. Like, you,
right, she requested it. Mm, to right. be that way,
like right. So, like, that felt like, oh, you're kind of wearing down. You're saying this thing, but you're like kind of taking exception and kind of being empathetic here. So it felt like it could have been on that course, but he is still killing her as you're calling out.
Right, so right.
Interesting.
I read that moment the same way, Michael, because when he goes into the bathroom and she's handcuffed to the thing. Right. She's like, I have kids. Like, I know how you can make things seem like, just don't make it look wrong. He looks down at her into her face. And then we hear the like forbid empathy. Empathy is weakness. It's like, it's almost like the movie is, you know, he's experiencing empathy sort of against his will and he's trying to tamp it down. And then he cuts her loose. And then, of course, he does kind of make it look like an accident. Right. And so I kind of read it the same way, where it's like, he's not ready to let somebody live, but he is bending a little bit his own rules here for Dolores. And so, yeah, I was convinced that he was more moving in that direction, maybe where, well, what it really signaled to me was that his choices were going to be more difficult choices, where it's like, if this, or at least, you know, sort of, he was going to be presented with thematically difficult choices that were going to force him up against his mantra or his worldview in direct opposition to them. So I really was expecting, as it went along from that point, you know, the hitman, I guess, that he goes after in Florida is like, that guy's the hardest to kill physically. Maybe not the hardest to kill emotionally, but still there's a struggle there, right? Like, there's still a struggle as it's going along. So that's the next person he kills after that. And then I was like, you know, there's the amount of effort should be proportional to the character work that's happening. And so I kind of was expecting that. And then I agree. I think it doesn't. It really, really fizzles out when it gets to that final guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what do we make about the Tilda Swinton sequence? Because I love the scene between the two of them. It's just delightful to watch her give a monologue at Michael Fassbender and, you know, sip whiskey, and it's fantastic. But it's interesting because it does feel like an important scene, and there's something, the movie's telling me something meaningful is maybe happening here, but like we're talking about, like, how it resolves doesn't feel meaningful in a I like the last moment where we see that she was ready to kill him with a knife. Like, I like how it ends up, but also I wasn't sure what the whole thing meant for him in his journey. How did you guys interpret that sequence?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I think, like you're saying, Alex, it felt like it was like that scene where someone's going to tell you the truth about yourself, you know,
right,
Mr. Protagonist, right. Like, and she's just immaculately executed on all fronts, that whole scene, but it did feel a little hollow. And I think maybe it is because between that midpoint, where I think, like you're saying, Trisha, that idea makes a lot of sense to me, of like, each choice is going to get harder and harder, it felt like that wasn't the case, and that the whole trip to Florida felt just kind of like a detour, playing the same level but on hard mode, and you're going to fight more people, but it didn't feel like it was pushing him as a character. And so when you then land in the Tilda Swinton, here is the truth you don't want to face, it felt like, oh, right, we're getting back to character arc stuff briefly. And then, as we've said, it kind of fizzled out after that. So, yeah, it was this weird scene. I had the same feeling of, like, on one hand, this is brilliant and I love everything it's doing. On the other hand, it's really not landing for me and I wish it was.
And even, like, the bear story, which was, like, a fun, hilarious, like, movie monologue story, like, I don't know, parable, but, like, I couldn't quite tell what it was a parable about and, like, how it described him and, like, what it meant for him and why he was there. So, yeah, it was a scene that was, like, projecting at me that, like, it was doing all these things that you would expect from this scene in the movie with the truth being told. And I didn't understand what the truth was. Mm-hmm. And that was a little bit frustrating.
Thematically speaking, I guess I've decided that this movie is sort of about late stage capitalism and the gig economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I noticed immediately this time, and by that I mean 20 minutes ago when I sat down to watch the beginning, that he's in a WeWork, right? Of course, mm-hmm. when yes. he goes to... goes to kill the first Mark. And then also, of course, there's, like, you know, a delivery guy that brings just, like, the mail and throws it in the door. And then there's the McDonald's and the tourists. And he's like, I used to rent on Airbnb a lot. And those super hosts love their nanny cams. And, like, there's so much of that in here, right? There's so much of, like, all of these brand names, the Amazon locker, the, like, Equinox, the gym, the all of this stuff. The way that people, you know, insulate themselves from other people, but also just strive to get one step above the next person in this, like, really cutthroat, you know, late stage capitalism kind of way. And the opening monologue is very much about that, right? It talks about the many and the few, right? And he's like, the blood of everything, the mortar that holds it all together, is that the few have always exploited the many, and you need to make sure you're part of the few and not the many. And then, of course, the button on the end is addressing that very thing. Maybe I'm a part of the many. Maybe I'm just like you, even though we know he's trying to be part of the few. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's interesting that the tour of revenge takes him through a lot of different places, right? People who are the very lowest of the low, like the taxi driver, who again is kind of working like this gig job and he's living essentially in poverty, right? All the way up to the billionaire in his office. And I think that the interesting sort of crux scene, as we're talking about with Tilda Swinton, is in this very upper class. She's not the very, very top of the heap, economically speaking, but he comments on it a lot. He's like, what are you doing out here in the suburbs? What are you doing among the normies, right? And she's got her regular table at her fancy restaurant and her personal bottle of whiskey that she just gets to drink from whenever she, like, shows up and sits at her regular table and knows the waiter by name. And she talks about being comfortable, right? Having enough money to be comfortable. I think the movie is very much sort of grappling with, at least in the text, his participation in this, right? He talks about not having any sort of country or creed, but he is adhering to this, like, I just want to have enough money worldview, and believes that everybody else is doing that too, that everybody else would stab you immediately if given the chance. And so that's kind of, I guess, what the movie is, I don't know, really sort of getting into. Is that true, right? In this world, is there space for real connection? Is there space for real community, real, I don't know, can these two people who really don't have to kill each other, they both happen to be assassins, but could they just share a drink over this table and everybody walk away, right? And of course, the answer is no. It's a bleak look at the state of the world, but I do think that there are a lot of signposts or sort of thematic engagements with that idea to essentially hold the movie together. However, I wish once we got to the billionaire, it was like, and here's where it all ends. The man at the very top, here he is. Like, what do we do with this guy? I wanted it to be that. I wanted there to be really, really clear, textual, here's where all of this stuff that I've been like, the water that I'm swimming in, all of these things, the consumerism, the like, all of the cutthroat everything. Here's where it all comes together with this guy who's pulling all the strings, who owns all the corporations. What do we do with this guy? And then the movie's just like, I'm going to walk away, which I think in itself is an interesting commentary, right? I mentioned at the beginning, like, right? Is there no escaping this? Is there any way at all to like deal with this guy? Or do we all just walk away and go try to find sit on our own beach somewhere? Or just in our own house? Why do you go back to your own house? They literally found you there already, sir. Anyway, but just, you know, do we, I think the movie is raising that question potentially. There's this like sort of, that's what I kind of mean, is that there's this meta theme to it, but it's not very strong in the filmmaking once we get to that guy. I think it's incredibly strong in the filmmaking with the Tilda Swinton character because they're literally talking about that, right? Which, but then once we get to that guy, they're not talking about that anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's where I'm grappling a little bit now is, you know, how much of this movie was the movie I thought I was watching and how much of it was me trying to like the decision that I had made about it now pasting it onto everything. Because what I kind of wanted from that scene with that guy, Claiborne, I think is his name, was for him to be like an actual evil person, but for Fassbender to let him go because he's not in his way. Right. So it's sort of like carrying on with that theme of like, it's not bad about being good or bad. It's just about worrying about yourself. You know, literally the line, what's in it for me? Like always think what's in it for me. Right. To me, I think that was the line that struck me. So I almost wanted the guy to be like the most killable person in the movie, but he's like, no, we're fine. As long as we're fine, I'm good or whatever. Right. I wanted it to like you said, really hang a lantern on the thematic, like this is what we're trying to say. And instead it's almost the opposite. It almost is that we're seeing a softening of the protagonist where it feels like the guy is just kind of hapless. And he's like, I don't know. They said like, I'll do a little bit more. I'm new to this kind of thing. And if I'm reading it correctly, the line where he says like a guy shows up to your house with a gun, you have no idea why he's here. Like is sort of saying like the guy is clean enough in this world to not be like, oh, which of the 17 reasons, like, you know, that you might be here to kill me, is it? So yeah, there's something there where I was like, ah, I wanted it to be more of this, or I wanted it to be less of that, or whatever. The Tilda Swinton scene, I was thinking more of just like these are equals in a way, and almost to the point where she is like the better of them. Like I want to see the Tilda Swinton prequel, right? Oh, so it's almost why I wanted him to like kill the person that we maybe like the most, and then like let the person that we like the least live, and sort of really kind of tie that together and be like, yeah, we are very much saying this guy is sort of he's the anti-theme guy or whatever. But you know, she has that line where she says like, oh yeah, when have we not had like a civilian get in the way between us and eyes on the prize? Right. And it's like, so what she is saying about his partner is exactly what he just did to the cab driver. Right. Like it's just, you know, so it's kind of saying, yeah, we're both in this together. We're both in this for the same thing. And like the bear joke, I think is a little bit, you know, and Walter White, I was thinking about just that sort of like, like, oh, I'm doing it for my family. I'm doing it for my family. No, I was doing it for me. Right. The sort of like, you're not in it for the reasons that maybe you tell yourself that you are in it for. And that's why I think that voiceover is so interesting. So yeah, again, I like that there's so much to sort of mull over, but I agree that part of the reason we're mulling over it is because it's not as clear and it's not as concrete as we want it to be. Also, watch the scene at the beginning of the Tilda Swinton scene where he sits down, where he grabs her purse and then sits down. She goes through 8 different moments. So and so I know what every single one of them means. It's like, hey, sorry, no, that's my purse. Wait a minute. You have a gun. Wait a minute. We're in a restaurant with people. Oh, you're the Dominican Republic guy. And there's nothing really I can do here. No. I'm probably about to die. And then she does like a little, And then before she says, like, I wish I had, you know, eaten more Haagen-Dazs or whatever, right? Yeah. But like, I cannot stress enough, like, what in beautiful acting that is, that that she goes through so many things and I know exactly what her inner monologue is in every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. That was maybe my favorite moment of the whole movie. Yeah. Just watching her play that moment was so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting because like you guys were saying, the final scene with Claiborne, it feels strangely one dimensional for being that finale scene, in the sense that it reads to me as just, oh, this guy is the most innocent and did the least direct harm to the woman I care about. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you shall live, in kind of this, yeah, like almost like old fashioned, only the guilty get to die in my code, which feels at odds, like we're saying, about the other, like, late stage capitalism, gig economy, soulless heartlessness of his inner monologue. And you know, it made me think also about when we talked about Dune way back when. I mean, it's, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, I've probably mentioned Dune quite a few times. I love the Denis Villeneuve Dune Part 1 movie. I'm mad that Part 2 is delayed. It's coming finally in March. but I do feel there's a big weak point in Dune Part 1, which is kind of the end of the movie, which culminates in this kind of underwhelming sequence, I would say, of this knife fight where Paul kills a man for the first time. And that is positioned by the movie as like the turning point. He has now crossed the threshold, now ready for Part 2. And yet the whole movie didn't really set me up for that as like the thing for Paul. And so when it happened and it was over and we're race to the finish, I didn't feel like I had just finished a big movie. It was just another scene that happened. And I had the same feeling with this Claiborne scene, where it didn't give me that last big scene of the movie feel. It was just, okay, that happened and now we're done. And it's interesting how movies, both those films seem to be doing something interesting thematically, and yet it's not giving me enough. It's not pointing me enough at the themes in the moment to feel that satisfaction that I want, that catharsis you want from a 3-act feature film structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On my way home from the movie, I was brainstorming. Now, at the time, I hadn't seen the first 20 minutes, but I was brainstorming like what would have tied it up, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, if there's this idea of like, don't fight any battle you're not paid to fight, ask yourself, what's in it for me? If this billionaire offers him a lot more money, right, not to kill him, that's like the most boring version of the way the scene could go. But it would align with something, right? Where he's like got the gun up perhaps against this guy's head and the guy's like, no, 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 no. What if, you know, I pay you this, this, this much money? It's so much more than you could ever make and ever. And like, that's the fight that you now have to fight. And like, we kind of see him wrestling with, okay, well, now I'm being paid to fight this battle, right? Or like, do I adhere to my philosophy, which is, get paid, or do I get the revenge that I want? That's a boring way that the scene could go, but something like that, where he's there, presumably he's taken a lot of work to get to that guy. The last time we heard from him in voiceover about his decision to even go after that guy in the first place was like, this could be a really tough guy to get, but like, screw it, I'm going after it. Okay. So we've seen you kill everybody else. You're coming after this guy, presumably to kill him. So what is making you change your mind? It has to be something. If you're headed in one trajectory, there has to be a climactic choice not to do it. I had this other thought that I was like, if maybe the downbeat ending is this guy is exactly like me in some unexpected way.
Right.
That's why I don't want to kill him, or there's something he gets in there. So, okay. Let's say the killer character is a collector of rare watches, something. Like, he doesn't have any hobbies or interests that we can tell, but what if he did, right? Like, what if along with his Apple smartwatch on his wrist, he also has like a vintage Rolex or something cool. Then he gets into this guy's apartment and he also has like some kind of collection. It doesn't have to be rare watches. It could be, you know, like whatever, statues, art, something, the same piece of art that Fassbender has in one of his storage units. I don't know. Like something that signals to us visually and to him that there's a similarity here, or like that actually this guy has the same values that you have and that there is going to be some way that you guys can meet on terms. Something like that, that makes him change direction. Whereas right now it's just kind of like he gives up and walks away. He's like, oh, you won't come after me again? Okay, never mind then. And that doesn't feel like anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really a weird scene. He does say, as he's talking to himself about going after him, you know, that, like you're saying, Trisha, this will be a hard one because the police look harder the more wealth right. you have. So it right. feels right. like there's a bigger risk in this person ending up dead for
but
him.
Bring it up again. Like once right. you're in no. the guy's apartment.
Right.
That's the pointing thing. Like, we can have this ending just remind us, like, that's why he made this choice, not because he felt morally obligated. Or
well, and like, and that doesn't feel like, a powerful character choice or like a thematic statement either. And one of the things that I believe Fincher talked about in the Q&A about that scene was sort of like the killer gets there and this guy is like the most clueless out of everybody. And so maybe that plugs into, you know, late stage capitalism. Everyone's hustling, trying to get to the top. He gets to the top and it's just a dude. Like it's just another human who knows.
It's just an idiot.
It's yeah. just an idiot. Right. right. Like right. no one actually is running the show. There isn't an evil bad guy at the top. Like it's just people running around being people. Maybe there is no few. I don't know. But again, like that's still not clear or and thus not satisfying because it doesn't plug in. There are all these places that have been set up where you could plug in some cool things, but we don't have the pieces at the end to plug them in.
Yeah, because even another thing you could plug in is more, I don't think it works in a story way, but just a meta commentary on just, you know, everybody turning against each other except for the people in power, you know, the billionaires who the people are fighting each other about, but never them, you know. So it's, I think there's something really interesting there too of I'm going to kill anybody except for people at the top. There's something socially thematic about that, but it's got to fit into the story also to work on both levels.
Yeah. I also think, I mean, let's face it, movie making and the people who sign the checks to make movies are among the few. And I do think that there's something an auteur can say, potentially on a meta level, about his employers. And I do think that there's perhaps something here. David Fincher commenting on his own career, right? He's been very critical of consumerism and capitalism all along, and people's worst impulses and society's worst places. And you know, I think maybe there's a, not a shrug here, but like, this is who the devil is. It's just this dummy. But I can't kill him because he's still signing my checks, right? Like there's perhaps there is something there, but again, I think you could have done it with a little more teeth if you were going to do it, you know, maybe, I don't know. I think it's interesting that like to think about the way that Fincher maybe does or does not relate to the protagonist of this movie and perhaps the facets of society that have unintentionally been like hurt or, you know, caught in the collateral damage of some of his commentary or and then the people who he's not ever able to actually touch with the movies that he makes because he's still making movies at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. Why don't we move into lessons? And my lesson is kind of about Fincheriness, so we can kind of carry that over there. But yeah, so lessons to take away from The Killer. For me, it's a very simple one, which is don't do fake handheld. maybe no one else in the world cares but me, but it drives me insane. Like I saw the trailer for this and there was handheld shots and Fincher doesn't do handheld. Like he hasn't done a handheld shot in like 15 years, the Social Network has a shot that begins as a tripod shot and then becomes handheld. That's really cool. And then a couple shots in, what's it called? Not the House of Cards, but the other one, Mindhunter. A couple of those shots or a couple of those things have handheld. And in the final shot of one of the Mindhunter seasons, there's a shot that starts handheld and then becomes like tripod, but you can't do that unless you're stabilizing it in post. And I hated it there. Anyway, I saw the trailer for this. There's handheld and I was excited. And I thought, okay, good. Someone's shaking Fincher and he's going to shake the camera. It's going to be great. And every handheld shot is fake digital handheld.
Wow. Fake
like,
handheld.
Added on top of it. And it was just like the most Finchery thing that like, even when you are going to pursue imperfection, you have to have complete control over right. your imperfection. And my lesson is it's too much. Like, it's too much. David, I love you, but just if it's going to be handheld, let it be handheld. I found that extremely distracting throughout every sequence of this movie. That's actually like the beginning of the second act. I was just so distracted by the fake handheld that I wasn't even following like the plot half the time. Anyway, so that was my experience. Don't do fake handheld, everyone. That's my lesson. Broadening it out, though, perfectionism when it comes to art, I think, is an interesting topic. Fincher is obviously a great case study because there's such a pursuit of perfectionism as detailed thus. I feel like before we wrap up the auteurness of the Fincher mode, where do you guys sit with like perfectionism, like intention in a storyteller, how much room needs to be left for the universe to have a hand in crafting whatever story is being told?
So this is not a lesson. This is you just want us to weigh in.
It's a lesson into a question, and then we'll get to other you guys.
We're lessons. Doing a detour.
It's a question.
Back to lessons. Yeah.
Fake okay. handheld. It's fault. It's not my fault.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there is something lost at times in the Fincher perfectionism for me, because there is a life that is breathed into a movie when you kind of allow accidents to happen. And I think you can just feel it in certain films where directors kind of find that middle ground where they both are obviously signaling, this is what I intended. I have complete control of my craft. And yet something about this performance or about this shot or about this moment feels like I could never have intentionally made it exactly this way. Like an accident happened and it was beautiful and magical and kind of could never have been planned. And you can just feel that, I think, unconsciously in certain movies. And I often don't feel that in Fincher products, you know, whether it's TV shows or like House of Cards is gorgeously cold and precise and perfect. But there's often scenes that don't feel very alive, you know, they're ice cold and delicious in their own way, but there's like a life missing, a lifeblood missing from it. So that's where I sit, I guess, is I really admire and love living in Fincher's worlds. But I think there could be this kind of one more dimension could be added to them if he could find some way to not let go of what makes him, but allow some of that magic accident life to creep into his movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times the things that excite us the most are the things that aren't quite right. You know, it's if you mock up, like, here is the perfect looking person, you know, attraction wise or whatever, you might be sort of like, okay. But then it's like when someone's like off a little bit, that makes it feel like you're the only one who like has a crush on that person, you know, then that's like more like, oh yeah, because they're kind of different looking or whatever, right? And you realize like you're one of a million people who are a billion people who feel that way. But yeah, I also think that, you know, we talked about Seven, like the ending doesn't quite like do the thing that you think. And it's like, I almost prefer that Seven is kind of messy at the end in terms of like, but wait, who was the, and then how did that work? Right. Or I don't know, 2001 or something, right? Like movies that were like still kind of picking apart, 'cause it's not all just like, tick, tick, tick. those are two different things, whether a movie all makes sense versus just like being perfectionist about how you do it. But I think it all kind of feels similar, where there's something, if things are done too well and too perfectly, then they lose their allure, they lose their charm, they lose kind of what makes them exciting. Whereas when there's something raw about it, whether it's they didn't have the budget, so they ended up having to do this, or whether it's that person decided to do this way because they just wanted to go against the norm, or whatever those things are, those tend to be the things that we talk about as the things that I think excite us the most.
Mm-hmm. When I think about a movie that has a lot of life in it, I think about Jurassic Park, actually. Like Jurassic Park, it just feels like so much of that movie feels almost spontaneous, and the acting almost feels improvisational at times, and yet it's this like highly crafted blockbuster, but there's like weird moments in it, like, and like kind of odd performance choices that all ultimately like feel right, but it has this almost quirky life imbued in it. I don't want David Fincher movies to feel like Jurassic Park, but I think it's an interesting example of like a highly produced blockbuster that is bursting with this accidental light aliveness that we're kind of pointing to.
I mean, Spielberg in general is sort of always balancing those things, right? Something that feels very personal and intimate. And like, this is like a weird, you know, I don't know, Alfred Molina, like when he's going to switch the thing and he's doing this like finger thing, you know, like these just like these weird things that happen that just feel like they came out of nowhere, mixing that with what is sort of a perfect blockbuster or a perfect film or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like humans, and I prefer them to robots, personally. But, I really feel the struggle as someone who is a total control freak, but also someone who believes in, like, people and magic and, like, all of our foibles and all of the accidents that happen when people get together to do things, because there's so much like push and pull, and, you know, we're all bound by like time and space and money. And it's really difficult to, you know, want to control everything and also not being able to control everything. And so I think that like the greatest filmmakers have held both of those things in tension. And I think that that's like, probably for the best. I think you need to be pulled in both directions. I think someone should make you compromise here and there. I don't think anybody should pursue perfection to the detriment of the present and the magnificent chaos of working with people. And so, yeah, I mean, look, Fincher's not for me most of the time, or like he's fine, but he's not my favorite filmmaker. And it's because of this thing, right? It's because you can sense that there's this, and part of it's the subject matter, but also it's the filmmaking, right? It's this endless pursuit of perfection that's not always to the benefit of the story and the way that the story can connect with the rest of us people. Like maybe David Fincher's ideal world would be to make movies for robots.
They are technically perfect. They're technically perfect. The robots could applaud.
The robots would love it. But I am not a robot, so I don't always love it. And that's where I'm at. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, thinking about the psychology of perfectionism, so what are you avoiding in the pursuit of perfectionism? You're avoiding embarrassment. And I think about Jurassic Park, there's some moments that are almost a little embarrassing. You know, there's like a little over the top, you know, performance of this line, or a little kind of like too raw when Allie's like, run and goes and like jumps on Alan Grant. It's like a little embarrassing, but it's also like messy and human. And I could never see a scene like that in a David Fincher film. Like everything's got to be very freaking cool in a David Fincher film. And I think that's why Seven does feel special, because it does feel like is an early film of his that is allowed to be messy, and humans have a little bit more of a imperfect, interesting performance. You know, like just thinking about the scenes at the dinner table with Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow, they don't feel as controlled as latter-day Fincher. because I feel like he doesn't want to be embarrassed. That's maybe I'm just projecting, but that's what it feels like. It's too cringe to have something be too
feelings
like
are too cringe.
Yeah, exactly. It's too raw. It's too emotional. It's too awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm sure if we asked Fincher, like, why is everything in your movie perfect? He would say, oh my God, it's so not perfect. Like, you think everything went perfect on set? Absolutely not. This is me trying to, like, you know, no actor's ever going to do exactly what you want. Something's going to fly by on the side of the take that's, you know, side of the shot that's distracting. But now there are all these tools that you can use to fight that war and get it closer to what you want. And yeah, first of all, I feel like where I'm at with Fincher is what I will say, is that I feel like you've already done it, Fincher. Like, you achieved perfection, yes, and you can henceforth only continue to to achieve perfection with the filmmaking, such that that is no longer interesting to me anymore, or like impressive. Like, what's after perfection? Like, what does it mean when you've gone too far? And you can turn around and say, like, oh, this view from over here, now I actually see the sweet spot is somewhere else. I feel like that is the continuation of this journey. And it's like a heck of a thing to be able to, like, have a filmography, as many of our tours that we're talking about do, where like every film meets some like minimum of quality. Like, that's extremely hard. But then what? Like, what is late stage auteur theory? Like, what happens
interesting.
Yeah, so maybe Napoleon will hold an answer. I feel like Ridley Scott is an interesting person to talk about all of that with, so I look forward to that.
I will say that I guess my lesson is going to be something we were talking about in the last episode with it was Killers of the Flower Moon. We were talking about selection of material, essentially. And like, you as a director bringing what you're interested in and finding material where that thematically dovetails in with what's already inherent in the story. And I really feel like that actually here. Like, I like The Killer more than I like a lot of other David Fincher movies. I perhaps could have said that up top. But I think that there's something really interesting and personal probably happening here, where Fincher sees himself in this character, and there's something like the perfectionism of the character is the text. And there's this fixation on like, if I can just order my life perfectly, I can be successful in this rat race that I've been put in. And that's like, there's nothing better than seeing, you know, 100,000 shots in a row of perfection when you're watching a movie about somebody who is pursuing perfection to the detriment of everything else, right? And I like that about this movie. I think that the filmmaking is speaking directly into the character and directly into the themes in a lot of the same way that Killers of the Flower Moon is, and honestly, probably Sofia Coppola's films as well. Like, we talked a lot about that. In what she brings to Priscilla as a subject. I just want to praise, I guess, the like, you, if you're an auteur with a lot of power and you can kind of make whatever you want, then pick something that you actually know a lot about or where you actually see yourself. Cause I think that that is where some of the most interesting things arise.
Yeah. Really quick, also before I forget, that kind of brings up something we talked about a little bit in Seven, a little bit with Scorsese, of like these directors that don't technically like write, but also clearly have a hand. And in the Q&A, made a joke that like, for some reason, Fincher doesn't feel like he should like, deserves a screenwriting credit. But like, with the implication being he was so involved that like he probably should have a screenwriting credit on this. And so just interesting, again, that aspect of these directors that also are clearly have a strong hand in the narrative. So just sharing that thought.
Yeah.
Alex, what's your lesson?
This movie really worked for me whenever we kind of sank into the present moment of a scene. And I think it's just a masterful movie of just like, that's why it reminded me of No Country for Old Men, honestly, was just there was so many great real-time sequences. We are just immersed in the ambient diegetic sound of a scene. It is no time is like compressed or expanded. We are just with a set of characters in usually some of the most, you know, stressful situations possible. You know, the killer is here. Now what do you do? And I just loved, you know, even though the movie as a whole didn't hold together for me, I loved anytime we got to those scenes where it's like, he's done all of his tricks to get in the door and get in this costume and get to here. And now we're here. And the movie, I think, just is a masterclass in just great suspenseful scenes and a great fight scene too. I mean, I call him the Beast, the yeah. Beast earlier, yeah. But I think his name is the Brute in the graphic novel chapter. But that fight scene was just so great because it was dark. It was incredibly like the lighting was very dark and moody, and yet the action was so crystal clear and the intensity was so like undeniable. The way the Brute was framed made him look just gigantic the entire time. And it was just, that's where I did feel like this is the Fincher effect. This is where I feel like I'm in the hands of a master, is just every moment of this fight scene is executed to perfection. And I'm just so happy to be here. I'm not zoning out. I'm not bored because I can't see what's happening. I can see exactly enough to know what's happening. And it feels like he decided exactly how much light to shine to let me see enough to follow the action. Anyway, I don't know if that's a clear lesson, except for this movie, I think, is definitely worth studying in those moments when the killer engages his subject of that chapter and we just get a great scene of some sort, whether it's a brutal fight scene or a suspenseful dialogue scene. They're just all masterclass scenes, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the sound design, obviously, in that scene throughout the whole movie, but that scene is just, Ren Kleiss is insane. He's probably so the best good. Ever. Yeah. Brian, what's your lesson?
My lesson is this movie shows you what happens if you listen to the Smiths too much. but no, you know, it's funny because there is something, well, there's two things going on here. One of which is I was thinking about why this movie doesn't feel on a sort of meta level, this movie doesn't feel new or exciting or fresh. And it's because like, everything in this movie, I've seen before and other, not everything, but like a lot of the things. So, you know, I've seen Boondock Saints and I've seen Baby Driver. I've seen the guy put in his headphones before he's going to go kill someone or before he's going to go investigate the crime scene or whatever. Right. And then the Ren Kleiss of it all is every time we switch, whether we're in his POV or not, then the music changes to either be sort of in, you know, the kind of non-diegetic versus diegetic. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I think it's like, yeah, Fincher is taking something that feels familiar and trying to be perfect with it and trying to do his best with it. But it kind of what we said with Sofia Coppola, right? Like her last two movies where I was saying like, oh, she does something I've seen before, but better. But I will say that I think there is something to be said about knowing what ideas are already out there and knowing what people have seen already. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like putting the headphones in to go to work. I'm digging up my guns for revenge because I'm John Wick. Here's all my passports because I'm Jason Bourne.
Strong John Wick vibe.
Yeah. here's my sort of soulless voiceover as I talk about my mantra because I'm Patrick Bateman, American Psycho, or other Fincher movies that are, you know, the sort of Fight Club nameless protagonist doing it, like execution and everything, which is the tagline of this, was the tagline of one of the Hitman games. And obviously the whole Hitman franchise, like very similar kind of stuff. So I think that, you know, I like this movie, but I think part of the thing I was saying at the top of the episode about there's something here that is leaving me wanting and wanting me to be more excited and what's the next thing, is how much of this movie feels like stuff I've already seen before, even if it is well done. So I guess, yeah, there's sort of a lesson there about just knowing what is out there, and knowing that, yes, maybe sometimes people want more of what's out there, but you're probably not going to be doing anything exciting or groundbreaking if you recycle those ideas. Also, this graphic novel was written from like 98 to 2014, I think. So probably it was based on some of these movies, right? So it's right. Probably like they're seeing these movies and then they're putting those ideas into their graphic novel. And then now we're making a movie about that. So it's sort of is like this recursive, never ending kind of thing happening here, which maybe just keeps it from feeling like as new or exciting as it as I would like it to have been.
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting thing with, you know, the auteur of it all again is like, do you expose yourself to other things, or do you right. say like hyper siloed and like, I'm not going to watch anything else. I'm just going to make my movies and not have any, receive any input. And like, there's interesting arguments for both ways. I really at the Q&A would have loved to ask who he makes his movies for, like who he imagines the audience for, like who he imagines the audience being when he's making these films. He did kind of make a comment of like, he's not really interested in engaging in filmography and that he's just kind of making whatever movie that he's making at any given time. Would have loved to push that more. But yeah, just it's an interesting thing of how much do you want to be influenced by other people. You can try to avoid that at all costs, but then maybe you're not receiving anything new or interesting that's spurring creativity. So,
well, yeah, peek behind the curtain. That was a conversation. I think something Michael and I fought about a little bit in LFTS videos was me being like, well, there's already a video on this, so maybe we should watch that. And him, Michael being like, no, because then we're not making my pure vision, or we're not doing my thing. And it's like, those are both perfectly valid points, right? One of which, right. and just like you're saying, one of which is, I can only make the thing that is me if I don't have that external input. The other of which is, if it's already out there, then people want to see what the next evolution of that idea is, right? And that's all fair. That's all valid.
Yeah, making things is hard. Randomly, but because we're probably never going to talk about this movie again, on the way to seeing this movie, I had the thought, because Death Cab for Cutie had just played a concert. I was listening to the Death Cab for Cutie cover of This Charming Man by the Smiths. And literally my brain was like, I feel like Fincher might randomly put like a Death Cab like song in a movie someday. And then in this movie, it's the Smiths, including like that song that they covered. So that's the end of my story. What else have you guys been watching recently? Brian, what have you been watching recently?
Hey, Trisha. I watched Network for the first time.
Oh my God. What did you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man.
It's awesome.
Right?
It's such a good movie.
Yeah. Network, 1976.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Sidney Lumet.
Network.
Yeah. With Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, Robert Duvall. I don't even want to say anything, because it's like, you who are listening, either know what this movie is. Like, if you haven't seen it, you either know what this movie is, so you kind of have an idea of what you're going in for, or you have no idea what this movie is, in which case stay that way and just go watch it as soon as possible.
Drop like everything. Go watch.
Yeah. I knew the memeable, you know, that in that Planet of the Apes Godfather way where you know all the references, right? And it's like, I knew that much. So I kind of knew what the hook of the movie was. And then I just had no idea where it was going to go. And it's so like, it's so cool where it goes. And it's so crazy that it goes like just every character like will go as far as they go. And it's so entertaining. And you can see how Aaron Sorkin just basically was like, I want to take every scene from Network and turn each scene from Network into its own show or movie. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's the opening of Sunset Show. Oh, that's all of The Newsroom. Okay. Yeah. And man, what a great movie. Like there are movies that I've been watching recently where I'm like, oh yeah, I appreciate why this is thought of as like one of the best movies of all time. And my appreciation brain is on. And Network, I'm like, I appreciate it so hard and I'm having such a blast watching it. And that's a really cool blend when that can happen.
Nice. I should rewatch it. I have not seen it in a very long time. And I think I've probably forgotten most of it, but I remember loving it.
Also, Faye Dunaway is incredible.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So in the last episode, I mentioned that I went and saw X which is an A24 horror film starring Mia Goth. I have not watched Pearl yet, which is the prequel to X, but I watched Infinity Pool, which also stars Mia Goth.
Wow.
The new Brandon Cronenberg movie, and it is a Cronenberg movie, that is for sure. It takes place in this like fictional country, which I didn't understand at first, but it's like a fictional like island vacation spot where their like local laws are actually really brutal and insane. And so the tourists are in like walled compounds. And the kind of hook of the movie is that if you do commit a crime, even by accident there, it's all like capital punishment. But because they want to encourage tourism, they can make a clone of you and kill that person. So that's kind of the hook of the movie. Then it goes from there, you know, and, you know, body horror ensues, you know, people, the darkest parts of human nature ensue. So if you want to dive into the darkest parts of the human psyche, check out Infinity Pool starring Alexander Skarsgård and Mia Goth.
Wow.
It is dark.
I like the sort of, I'm thinking now about Francis Ford Coppola movies versus Sofia Coppola movies and how they could be more different. And then David Cronenberg movies versus Brandon Cronenberg movies, where it's like, okay, yeah, that's
the lineage is very clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
Yeah. So last night, actually, as a matter of fact, from when we're recording this, I watched a new screwball comedy. It's very old, but it was new to me. A screwball comedy that I'd never seen before.
Five Nights at Freddy's.
Listen, I'm going to be mad about that for like a long time. Listen, I know that that's based on a video game and also that middle schoolers really love it, but I did not really love it. We'll put it that way. No, so I watched The Palm Beach Story, which is from 1942, starring Claudette Colbert and Joel McRae. And I really just enjoyed this movie. It's a screwball comedy from the golden age of screwball comedies. And who doesn't love those? And I don't know. It's, you know, it's one of those films where it feels surprisingly mature and not at all clutching its pearls about like sex and marriage and, you know, all of these things. And Joel McRae and Claudette Colbert are married. He's a failed inventor who needs $99,000 to like fund his greatest invention ever, but he's totally broke. And she's super hot. And she's like, listen, I'm super hot. If I divorce you, I can marry a true millionaire and get you the money you need for your invention. I'm more useful to you, divorced to you, than married to you. Wow. And so she goes to Palm Beach to get a divorce and hijinks ensue. It's great. It's just really great. It's really watchable and fun. And it's among the greatest screwball comedies ever, apparently, but I'd never seen it. And I had a blast. My mom is visiting me right now, so she and I watched that last night and laughed our heads off. It was wonderful.
Nice. That sounds fun.
We should do screwball comedy sometime.
Oh, yes.
I feel like we should do that.
Fun. Yeah. Nice.
Agree.
Okay, Michael? Well, I'm going to do the requisite talking about the latest Malcolm Gladwell podcast now. And I feel like it's thematically, I think it connects because a big focus of the season was a 6-part series on guns and gun violence. And I feel like a lot of us are like, have made up our minds on how we feel about guns in general. What I appreciated about this dive into guns was all the different angles that the podcast takes and sort of looks at culturally. We have sort of this myth of, you know, cowboys and you got to wear your own gun to protect yourself. You never know what's going to happen. Where did that come from? And so he looks at television and gun smoke and sort of like this myth of the Wild Wild West that was entirely fabricated by television writers that actually didn't reflect the gun control laws, and the Wild West were actually extremely progressive, more than we have today. So he talks about that. He talks about why we're using court cases from hundreds of years ago when our Supreme Court, like, you know, arguments. He looks at like how guns kill people and homicide rates and what actually determines homicide rates and how doctors have just gotten so good at keeping people alive, that in many cities, homicide rates are going down when gun violence is like shooting up like exponentially. Mm. And so basically it's just like this really interesting wake up call of like, even if you feel like you're kind of tuned into the conversation, there's all these factors that we kind of often think we have a intuitive sense of or common sense knowledge of. And he pokes at those and does a nice little like wake up call for lots of things, which is really interesting. Like how far away you live from a trauma center also determines how likely you are to die from, you know, gun violence. And spoiler alert, a lot of the poorer neighborhoods, people of color are the furthest away. And so that's often why neighborhoods of color have the higher homicide rates. It's not because they're shooting. Anyway, just a lot of really interesting things, and it felt like an appropriate call out for a movie called The Killer, which there's lots of guns and killing people.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really interesting and engaging. It's
really depressing about the Wild West.
Yeah.
They had stronger gun control laws than America in 2023.
Yeah.
Here we are.
The city of Dodge, where it's like, oh, I got to get out of Dodge. And like, oh my God, it was so wild. Like, yeah, the crime rate was like way less than like
actually
most of
very chill in Dodge.
Yeah.
So anyway, just good to have those wake up calls occasionally.
Nice.
All right. Well, this has been our conversation on The Killer and wrapping up our conversation about auteur David Fincher. Next week, we'll be moving into Prometheus and conversation about auteur Ridley Scott, who we've talked about a lot of his movies. So I think this will be a, we can draw on that. We can look at Prometheus, try to figure out lots of stuff about that. That'll be really fun. Very much looking forward to Napoleon the week after. If you want to listen to the Prometheus episode and help us make more episodes, then head over to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon and support us. You'll get access to that episode as well as our Killers of the Flower Moon episode, which is also a really fun conversation, and our Rear Window episode that happened back in September. Again, it was fun to see like that first sequence of The Killer. I was like, oh, I'm glad we just talked about Rear Window, because it's kind of, well, the same.
I'll stick to the plan. Just remember what's in it for me.
Another great real-time scene, that Rear Window scene when the like diplomat or whoever that was arrived in the hotel. So yeah, good in right. The Killer.
Yes. Like,
so good.
That is a casting swap now, Brian, that is in my head. And that would be amazing. I want to say thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Donovan Bullen, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I'm joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you over on the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon next Friday for Prometheus.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.